I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Before the news the last couple days, we thought we would focus exclusively on the G20 summit in Germany, which gained a lot of attention for the president's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, for the United States withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, for the negotiations on a Syrian ceasefire, and disagreements about trade. Well, we had news, a lot of news, yesterday and today. So because of who our guest is and the nature of the news, we're probably going to start with this story. Donald Trump Jr. agreeing to meet with a Russian lawyer who had damaging information on Hillary Clinton after receiving an email that the Russian government was trying to help his father win the election. Could Donald Trump Jr. have crossed the legal line on collusion with Russia? We will start our conversation this hour with that particular topic, and then move into many other important topics like trade and climate, etc. Our guest is Nicholas Burns. He is professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, founder and faculty director of the Future of Diplomacy Project, faculty chair for programs on the Middle East and on India and South Asia. He has a long and distinguished career in government service for 27 years, actually, under Secretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008, led negotiations on the U.S.-India Civil Nuclear Agreement, lead U.S. negotiator on Iran's nuclear program, U.S. ambassador to NATO, ambassador to Greece, worked for 5 years from 1990 to 1995 on the National Security Council at the White House, where he was senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia affairs. And he was special assistant to President Clinton and director of Soviet affairs in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. So his knowledge of Russia is deep, and we will be talking to him about this story. That was originally the story came from the New York Times. They were preparing to publish a story today that had all of the emails. They secured all of the emails that Donald Trump Jr. had received. They were preparing to publish the story when Donald Jr. Asked for more time to comment and then preempted them on the story and tweeted them out, all of the emails that he had received from these intermediaries on behalf of Russia. It's a big story today, and we will talk about the significance of the story. We will also be looking at, we're just waiting for our guest in case you're wondering what I'm doing. I'm just talking for a little while. We'll also talk about the many stories coming out of the G20 summit. The United States, a lot of analysts are saying, was the dominant force and really set the agenda at the gathering of the leaders of the world's largest economies. The United States found itself rather isolated on many issues, trade issues, climate issues. Most of the countries supported the Paris Accord on climate change. The United States withdrew from that accord. And so we will talk about the communique that was issued. Number of disagreements about trade. Donald Trump believes that the United States has been disadvantaged by sweeping trade-free agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and believes that the steel industry has been particularly hard hit by globalization. Sometime soon, actually, he could impose restrictions and also new tariffs on steel imports. And there are worries that that could provoke a global trade war. The European Commissioner President said on Friday, we will respond with countermeasures if need be. We're prepared to take up arms if need be. And that could include American whiskey imports. They could react with countermeasures. And of course, we'll talk about that meeting with President Putin and what indeed the Russians were trying to accomplish in the election, the overture that was made to Donald Trump Jr. and why he accepted it, and if this is really a smoking gun and bad news for the Trump administration when it comes to not only contacts with Russia by members of the campaign, but also a possible collusion. So all of that is on the table, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Here's how you reach the conversation with the former ambassador: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always love to read your messages, and we are on Twitter and that is at K Dunn Show. Hour two of our program this Tuesday, Nancy Pearl will be joining us. She's been our guest for many, many years. She has read more books than any human being I know of, but not only has she read a lot of books, she has remembered all these books. So she'll offer great summer reads, a list she has prepared just for us, and also we'll be able to answer your specific questions about certain kinds of genres you may like, children's books or young adult books, fiction and nonfiction. If you liked a certain author, then who might you like in addition to that author? She's just wonderful in all those regards, and she will be joining us the second hour of the program to give book recommendations. It's something that she does several times a year. And we'll also give you information. Nancy and I are going to be at Boswell Books on September 8th. September 9th. It's a Saturday evening. We will be chatting about her new novel. She's written a novel, George and Lizzie. So we'll talk about that and also about the many books that she has written and all the books that she is suggesting. And I believe that we have the ambassador with us, so we will be going to him and talking about this news concerning Donald Trump Jr. and also all the news coming from the G20 summit. Ambassador Burns, you know everything about so many foreign policy areas. You are the perfect person to have on the air today. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah, great to have
you
here.
Nice to have you.
I didn't think that we were going to be talking about this, but you're a Russian expert in addition to everything else and know this country pretty thoroughly. What do you make of Donald Trump Jr. agreeing to this meeting with a Russian lawyer who had damaging information on Hillary Clinton after he received an email from this intermediary that the Russian government was trying to help his father win the election? Is this a big deal?
I think it's a very big deal. You know, I just want to say to your listeners, I'm not an attorney, obviously. I'm certainly not a judge. So I really can't, I don't have a good sense of the legal bar here, whether this amounts to collusion. That's for the special counsel, Robert Mueller, to decide. But as a foreign policy professional, I know this. Russia is our strongest, along with North Korea, our strongest adversary in the world and the most dangerous adversary to the United States. If Donald Trump Jr. thought he was meeting with someone representing the Russian government, if that's the case, and he released his own emails today, and at least he was told that he'd be meeting with a Russian government attorney, the proper thing would have been to have said, I will not meet with anyone representing the Russian government, and he should have alerted the FBI. Because you cannot have a situation in a presidential campaign where one campaign effectively tries to work with a foreign, an adversary government, an aggressive power to the United States, and try to sway the election. It's just wrong. But I'll leave it to the lawyers and judges and special counsels to decide, obviously, we'll have to, whether this amounts to collusion itself.
Ambassador Burns, why do you call Russia our most dangerous adversary?
Well, President Putin has been in power for 18 years now.
Wow.
Has, ever since 1999, has run a foreign policy that has tried to harm the interests of the United States. It's the country that has the greatest nuclear weapons force trained on us. I mean, ready to work against us, God forbid, if we ever got into a war. It's our greatest possible adversary, number one. Number two, it's trying to undermine the NATO alliance and the European Union, the two most important partners that we have anywhere in the world. It's actively trying to push the United States out of having an influential position in Syria and Iraq. And, of course, you know, Putin runs, he's a former KGB agent, he runs an authoritarian dictatorship in Russia itself, and he's trying to undermine the confidence that Americans have in our own democracy. I believe the intelligence community, when it is said unanimously in its report to the American people in early January of this year, that Russia launched a major and very sophisticated cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee, but also on over 30 American states. They tried to get into our databases, our voter registration rolls. That's a fundamental threat to the democracy and the sanctity of our elections. And as an American, I find it offensive. And I want us to contain that kind of power and ultimately overcome it, and certainly want to strengthen our electoral system. And as you know, in our country, the federal government doesn't run our elections. They have nothing to do with them. The elections are run by states and counties and towns. So we've got to strengthen the computer systems and the databases of all of our many thousands of voting districts so that the Russians can't penetrate and warp the elections and therefore warp the will of the American people.
Well, 2018 isn't very far away. What are we doing now to make sure those systems are secure?
I think not enough. The secretaries of state of each state in America, they have an association. They just met last week, and they were talking about this. And they certainly need the advice of the Department of Homeland Security in Washington, because that's where a lot of our expertise resides. And the federal government needs to reach out and volunteer to help each state. And each state will have different capacity. Some states still have, and counties still have, paper ballots. That's probably the most secure way to vote, by the way. Some states have old voting machines that aren't able to record basic information about the vote beyond a yes or no. And so you've really got to put a lot of money and thought into protecting this system from foreign powers, because you remember the Russians. So the Russians hacked in, but remember the North Koreans also hacked into the Sony Corporation. And in the cyber world in which we live, there are a lot of state countries and there are a lot of individuals who would do us harm. And so protecting our elections all over the United States is nothing more important. We need a major national effort to do this.
You spent a great deal of time studying Russia. You worked for a number of years on the National Security Council. You were senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia Affairs. You were special assistant to President Clinton, director for Soviet Affairs in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm glad that you're our guest, because I'm trying to get some sense of what it is the Russians are actively doing to undermine, some have said, democracy in the United States, and how successful they have been, particularly during this administration. What's their game plan?
I think that, you know, the Russians are not nearly as strong as us. We have a larger and much more free and innovative economy. We have a more powerful military globally. We're certainly more influential politically because we're a democracy, and so other countries trust us more than they trust the Russians. But the Russians have a big nuclear weapons force, and that is equal, roughly, to our nuclear weapons force, and so they can do us great harm. They understand they can't defeat the United States, so they want to discredit our brand. They want to discredit our credibility overseas, and they want to, I think, sow confusion within the United States. And they've done that. Mm-hmm. It's a tragic that they've done that, because by interfering in our elections, now you have this big political controversy that has very different permutations about the Trump administration. Did the Trump campaign actively work with the Russians against Hillary Clinton? No, we don't know the answer to that. It hasn't been proven yet. It's been alleged by some people, but that's what the special counsel, the former FBI director Robert Mueller, is looking into. That's one issue. A second issue is whether President Trump, since January 20th, when he was inaugurated, did he obstruct the pursuit of justice by trying to obstruct the FBI investigation into the first issue. And now a third issue has come up, and that is, are the Russians continuing today to try to actively undermine American democracy? Are they going to try to intervene in the 2018 midterm elections and the 2020, the next presidential election that we'll have in 2020? And so we've got multiple levels of a crisis here, and they're often confused, but they are multiple separate issues. And the Russians, I think, want to diminish the reliability of the United States, and I think diminish the trust that Americans have in Washington. And I hope we don't let them do that. I mean, Wisconsin, I know, is now a state where you've got strong Republican representation. The Speaker of the House comes from Janesville.
Right.
You've got strong Democrats as well. You're kind of a perfect example of a nation balanced between both political parties. And I hope, just as a citizen, I come from Massachusetts, but that we would always all remember we're Americans first, Democrats and Republicans second, and let's not let the Russians prey on our internal divisions. Let's stand united against what the Russians are doing. And that's where I think President Trump has made a really big mistake. What he's been saying consistently is he doesn't agree with the U.S. intelligence community that Russia intervened in the 2016 election. He said that again last week. He doesn't agree. He doesn't trust their view. And in his meeting with President Putin in Hamburg, Germany last weekend, he seemed to indicate that when President Putin denied that Russia had intervened in our elections, President Trump seemed to take that at face value and say, okay, if you've denied it, then we'll move on. Well, why would any American trust Vladimir Putin over the FBI or the CIA? The FBI and CIA are American organizations. They're patriotic. They're filled with people who want to help the United States, our own citizens, and Putin is somebody who comes from the KGB. Why would we ever trust him? So I think there's been a fundamental error here made by President Trump.
That meeting with Putin was really long, over 2 hours. Is it unusual to not have much of a sense of what went on in that meeting? Do you know at all what they talked about for that long a period of time?
It's not unusual. I participated when I worked in the White House. I helped to put together 23 U.S., Soviet, and U.S., Russian summits for President Bush and President Clinton. And so it's, you know, some of what is discussed has to remain confidential because it's privileged information or sometimes that we don't want to see for national security reasons made public. But I think it's good that they met for 2.5 hours because you want President Trump, first of all, he'd never met President Putin. So they need to have the first meeting. They need to get a sense of each other. They need to establish an effective way to communicate with each other because if there's a crisis, you want them to be able to speak clearly and convincingly to each other. So I thought that was probably the main goal of the meeting. Second, we have so many differences with the Russians. You know, you have to work those out. From what we do know, from what Secretary Tillerson said about the meeting and what the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said, it doesn't appear that President Trump raised the election hacking issue in a very aggressive way. In fact, Secretary Tillerson said after the meeting, well, they just kind of agreed to disagree. Well, that's not what you do. If you think that Russia hacked our election, then you don't take Putin's denial at face value. In fact, you distrust Putin. And you, I think the proper recourse for President Trump now would be to back the bill in the Senate, which was voted on by a 97-2 margin. So 97 Republican and Democrats said, we want to sanction Russia economically over its interference in our election. Only 2 members of the Senate voted against it. I think 1 member was absent, obviously. That's a huge margin. It's bipartisan. And the president should get behind the Congress, and I hope Speaker Ryan will support this, and we should sanction Russia. That's language Putin understands. That's a penalty to him. But if you let him off, and if you accept his word, and I'm sure he's not telling the truth, that he didn't intervene, well, he says it's going to give him license to intervene in our elections in the future. So we got to be smart about this.
This isn't fair, but I'm going to ask you, because you understand Russia better than most of us, to put yourself inside the head of Putin and the Russian government. As he is looking on with the news of the last couple days and this meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and the Russian government having information damaging and coming from the government, which is why Trump Jr. decided to take this meeting, would you be pleased by what's happening here, or would you be thinking, ooh, this isn't good for the person I helped get in office?
I think probably a little bit of both, to be honest with you. If I understand Putin correctly, he's a very cynical guy, and he's also highly opportunistic. He wants to weaken us. If we now are engaged, you know, in months or years of political battles in Washington over President Trump's relationship with the Russians, that's going to weaken the United States. It's going to take our eye off what we have to do, and so Putin will be happy about that. On the other hand, as you say, I think quite correctly, what the CIA and FBI believe and the NSA is that Putin actually intervened in the summer and autumn of 2016 to help Donald Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. That's their conclusion, not mine. If that's the case, I don't think Putin wants to see President Trump too weakened, because I think he perceives President Trump as being, and I know a lot of his supporters might like me using this word, but I think it's accurate. I think Putin perceives President Trump to be weak and someone who can be manipulated. He knew he couldn't manipulate. He couldn't manipulate Paul Ryan. He couldn't not manipulate John McCain. He certainly could never have manipulated Hillary Clinton. But I think they perceive that President Trump is weak. And that worries me as an American. I don't want my president to be considered to be weak. by our strongest adversary in the world.
The other thing that's happened is that it's so dominating the news. It's what we talk about. It's everywhere. We have all these issues. Healthcare, which
right.
The Senate is going to be considering and delaying their recess. We've got trade issues. We've got all kinds of issues. And yet the enormity of this Russian involvement connection has been dominating our news for months and months and months.
Well, it has. And, you know, it's a very important issue. This is a big, important issue of national security, of protecting our democracy. And I think, and I'm someone who, I was a teenager during Watergate 4 decades ago, so I remember that. The big takeaway for me from Watergate, I think, applies today. And that is that no person in our society, including the President of the United States, is above law. And so everyone has to be accountable to that. And I don't know where this is going to lead. It may turn out that there was not collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And if that's what the evidence shows, then we should all respect that and move on. If on the other case it turns out that there was, well, then that's a matter for the court system and for the special counsel and the Justice Department. And I think I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to put myself in the position of judging, but I do think there's enough smoke there that you at least have to have this investigation. So I support the investigation. But you're right, as we look at this and are consumed by the Russia issue, and I thought, you know, Wisconsin played this role in the campaign. There are a lot of people hurting. There are a lot of people who are either out of work or, if they're not out of work, are not able to earn the kind of living that they need to earn.
Yes.
There are a lot of poor people and people who aren't trained to work in a 21st century economy. And boy, do we have to turn our attention to that. And I drove through your state. My wife and I came through Wisconsin on a cross-country drive last summer. We visited. I'd always wanted to go to Madison and see the University of Wisconsin, and we did. What a beautiful place that is. But, you know, in every state of the union, every single one, you can see the poor infrastructure. You can see our rusting bridges, the interstates that need to be repaired, our mass transit in our cities, places like Milwaukee or even where I live, Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts. We have an ancient, creaking public subway system. More than 1 million people a day ride it, and yet it breaks down in the snow and ice. And so we've got to invest in our own country. And I think you're right that we've got to keep focused on this Russia thing, but not to the exclusion of trying to fix the problems that I think the average American wants to see Washington fix.
It was said some months ago that this special counsel's investigation could go on for years. Do you think that it's going to go, all these investigations are going on for years?
Well, I think it's going to be protracted. I don't know quite how long it'll go, but it wouldn't surprise me if we really don't hear much publicly from the special counsel, Mr. Mueller, until 2018, because he's just now assembling a big staff of lawyers so that he could actually conduct this investigation, which now, with Donald Trump Jr.'s revelations, goes off into another labyrinth. Mm-hmm. And he's got to be very careful here. He's got to be fair. He can't be guided by politics, and he won't be, because he's a very upstanding man. And he's been our director of the FBI for 12 years. He's been a judge. So he's got to kind of follow the evidence where it leads him, and that might take a very long time, and fair to everybody involved. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if we, the public, don't really get a sense of where this is heading until next year.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns is our guest this hour, and we're going to start welcoming phone calls almost momentarily, I should say. He is now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at Harvard Kennedy School. He's had a very, very long career as a diplomat. He served in the U.S. government for 27 years. Pertinent to our conversation this hour, he was on the National Security Council at the White House, senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia Affairs from 1990 to 1995, special assistant to President Clinton, director of Soviet Affairs in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush, and he has been an ambassador, U.S. ambassador to NATO, and ambassador also to Greece, among many other government service positions he has held. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're particularly interested in your response to the stories that have been dominating the news today and yesterday. Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer and a whole series of emails that were released by Donald Trump Jr., but the New York Times forced the issue because they had the story and told them they were going to print it, and then he did come up with all of these emails that showed that the intermediary said that the Russian government had information that was damaging to Hillary Clinton and thought it would be useful for the Trump campaign because Russia was supporting Donald Trump. So it's a big story. What do you make of it? And we'll talk more about what happened at the G20. So we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, we go to phone calls now, and we start with Dennis in Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. A concern I have is it's pretty common for an underling, whether a son or whatever, say, well, the boss, the president, whatever, no, they had no idea what I was doing. But the thing is, in this case, this president can pardon an underling or especially a son. And the son, Donald Trump Jr., can take whatever comes his way and still be pardoned. So there's would be very little risk as far as legal action.
Ambassador.
Well, I think that's true. The president does have the power to pardon really almost anybody in our society. You remember President Ford pardoned President Nixon, who had resigned over Watergate so that he would not be prosecuted. In this case, though, Dennis, I think that the what President Trump has to be careful about is to not appear that if he did pardon people, hypothetically, he was obstructing the pursuit of justice. It'd be one thing to pardon, but the special counsel would still have a right to question Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, these people who were involved in this meeting with this Russian attorney more than a year ago. And where President Trump, I think, has misstepped in the last couple of months is he has made a lot of public statements that appear to be trying to prevent this full investigation. When he fired Director Jim Comey, who was very widely respected by both political parties in Washington, the appearance was, by the president, I'm trying to stop this investigation. And so it was very positive that Robert Mueller was brought on to be the special counsel in response. So I do think he's got to be careful here, and that Robert Mueller is going to get to the bottom of this one way or another. And that's important for our democracy.
Thank you, Dennis, for your call. David in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering if the guest can tell me anything about how this situation with Trump differs from Hillary Clinton's situation with the emails. I'm from a family that's pretty left of center on most issues, and we always complained that the right was making far too big of a deal about emails and that things were just blowing up, but there was never any fire for the smoke, and it was just much ado about nothing. But I'm trying to see if I'm being hypocritical by saying all of these things that I'm hearing without any firm statement that Trump did something bad, if I'm actually doing the same thing I was criticizing the right for.
David, I think there are two very different situations. On Secretary Hillary Clinton's emails, she had a private server in her house in New York, and that was not a good idea. It was a big mistake because it opened her up possibly to some foreign adversarial power hacking in to a server that was not going to be as protected as you'd find in the State Department or White House in Washington, D.C. So it was a mistake, a big mistake, and she said that during the campaign. The issue of President Trump is completely different. He is actually openly disagreeing with our intelligence community about whether or not Russia intervened in our election. And now that's one issue where I think his judgment is very faulty. He's been very unwise to almost to believe the Russian government over the U.S. government, permanent government, civil servants on this. Secondly, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm like you, I'm just reacting to the, if you haven't seen it, Donald Trump Jr. released today a series of emails that he had sent with intermediaries to set up this meeting a year ago, more than a year ago, with a Russian lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give you an expert opinion, but as a civilian, I can say he was told in one of the emails that he would be meeting with someone who had been contacted by a senior Russian government official.
if I had received that email, I think if you had received that email, if any American, most Americans receiving that, we would have run away and said, we're not going to meet with this Russian lawyer. If she is representing the Russian government or has been in contact with them, we don't want to be in a position of helping the Russian government affect our election. I think the big mistake that Donald Trump Jr. made was in actually agreeing to this meeting. And then the second big mistake he made was not reporting it to the FBI once he had the meeting, once he found out what this woman, what kind of information she wanted to offer. So that's just my own view, but what's more important is what special counsel will think of this.
Well, he also first said, well, this was about adoptions, and then Reince Priebus said it's a big nothing burger, and then it was about something else. The story kept changing. If you're to be believed, you have to just tell the truth, don't you?
Well, I think the Trump administration has had a real problem in being consistent in what they say to the public. And this is a very good example. They've had four or five different explanations in 3 days about why this meeting was held and what its purpose was. And the other problem they've got, the big problem, is that President Trump's tweets. Now, I do follow him on Twitter because you can't really understand Washington if you don't. But he tweets every morning, and he often tweets things that are directly contrary to what his spokesperson or even the Secretary of State has said publicly. So he undercuts his own officials. And he confuses a lot of people as to whether what he's saying is true or not.
Let's go back to the G20. I know our listeners, and that's fine, want to talk about the news of the day, which we'll get back to your phone calls in a moment. But I want to make sure that we get into some other issues here. The president believes the U.S. has been at a disadvantage by trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's talked a lot about the steel industry and how they have been savaged by globalization. There is reporting that he could very soon now impose new tariffs on steel imports, which resulted in this comment from the European Commission president on Friday. We will respond with countermeasures if need be. We are prepared to take up arms if need be, and that could include American whiskey imports. Does the president have a real important point here that a lot of workers have been harmed by these kinds of trade agreements? And what would happen if there were tariffs on steel all of a sudden?
Well, I think it's a big, complex subject. I think the president obviously reached a lot of Americans during the campaign, including in Wisconsin, including in Massachusetts, where I live, with this point.
Mm-hmm.
Trade is so complicated. I would say that in general, over the last 40 to 50 years, the United States economy and American workers and American citizens have profited from the fact that we've been open to trade. It's pushed a lot of American exports out to the rest of the world, made a lot of money for our companies and workers in doing that. It's provided a lot of American jobs. There are varying figures, but one of every six or seven American jobs depends on our ability to export. So you can't be a closed economy in the 21st century. You have to be open to trade. So an unbalanced trade has helped the American economy, helped most Americans succeed, and certainly helped other countries to grow, and that's good for us to see sub-Saharan African countries growing at such a fast clip, to see India, for instance, grow. But there's definitely a downside, too. And here's where President Trump, I thought, made some valid points and continues to make some valid points. And people are responding to him that in certain industries where the United States no longer has a comparative advantage, where either the cost of production or the cost of our wages is so high that we're no longer that competitive, we've lost jobs. Certainly in middle America, there are towns in Massachusetts that are hollowed out by this. These names might not mean much to people in Wisconsin who don't know our state, but Fall River, Massachusetts, New Bedford, Massachusetts, Springfield, these towns have really lost most of their manufacturing jobs over the last couple of decades. I know that's the reality in the Midwest. And so, to be honest, we've got to have a better conversation about this in America, rather than say we shouldn't be trading at all, which is a Trump position. No multilateral trade agreements. Or the other side, that free trade is wonderful. We've got to be smart, and we've got to look at this in an honest way and try to help the workers who've been displaced. Some of the jobs, honestly, probably will never come back. We're never going to be the major steel producer in the world. We don't, because the cost of production is too high here. If that's the case, then we owe it to the people of Ohio and West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, people who've lost their jobs, to retrain them. We ought to have a big social safety net to help people survive and hopefully prosper in the future. President Trump, I think rightfully, I think he went to Wisconsin for this, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
a couple
he did.
Months ago.
Mm-hmm.
He came to talk about what we can do to improve vocational training schools. We need to do much more, but that means federal money. It means federal money for states like Wisconsin and Ohio, and we've got to do more of that. So I do think we have to be honest. Free trade has hurt a lot of people. I think it's helped more, but we're all Americans. We don't want to see millions of Americans left behind, and so you got to help them.
We're going to Willem next in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I think Donald Trump's really done a lot of harm to our country on a national, international scale. I listen to Radio Netherlands, and I read The Guardian and listen to BBC and other foreign news sources, and I think that he's done real damage to the reputation of our country, a man who I think both by intellect and temperament is unqualified for the job. Like, he's the direct opposite of George Washington, both in intellect and temperament. And I think that he's, you know, as far as this inability for the United States to compete in steel, like you mentioned, is the cost of production is, the problem with the cost of production is that Americans were used to making living wages, and capital has chased cheap labor all over the world. If you want to look at a lot of clothing, they're now made in Vietnam. And it's not because the Vietnamese are better clothes makers. It's because they're the cheapest labor pool in the world. So I think that it's disingenuous of Donald Trump, someone who him and his daughter both have their products manufactured in China, not because they love the Chinese, but because it's cheap labor. So, and the problem with Donald Trump is you had a guest on, David Johnston, who wrote a book, The Making of Donald Trump, who's covered Donald Trump for 30 years. And I think if you read that and you observe Donald Trump, he is not a trustworthy person. I wouldn't want him to be the president of my village, let alone the president of the United States. He is proven by his own words to be a dishonest person, what we used to call a liar. And, you know, he's a bully. I think the United States can't move forward until we impeach Donald Trump.
Thanks for the call, Willem. Ambassador Burns.
Well, there's so much there to discuss.
Right.
I would just say that I thought that was a... I agree with a lot of what Willem said in his comment. I've worked for both parties and am kind of a centrist on most issues, and certainly want an America where Republicans and Democrats can talk to each other and work together. I don't think President Trump is that type of leader. He divides us. He doesn't unite us. If you think of Lincoln as the great uniter, Donald Trump's the great divider. I don't think he's got the intellect or temperament to be president. What's bothered me as a citizen more than anything else is the way he has denigrated the press and the way he's gone after the press, the whole thing about fake news. You know, in government you learn that the press is so critical to keep the government honest and to question authority. And that's why the framers of the Constitution, Madison and Hamilton and John Jay, the First Amendment protects press freedoms. And to turn Americans, or try to turn Americans against the press, I think does great damage to the fabric of our society. So I do think he's been a failure in his first 7 months as president. And I really hope that, I think we need to see more congressional leadership now. If the president is leading badly on many issues, and if on the issue of Russia he refuses to lead and defend us, I think that Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell, a lot of these Republicans who are in the majority, they need to provide the sane adult leadership. I have great respect for Speaker Ryan as well as Mitch McConnell. And certainly Chuck Schumer, the leader, and Nancy Pelosi, the two Democratic leaders. I'd rather see the four of them begin to really express congressional leadership, because I think that's what America needs right now.
Hmm. Going back to the G20 for a moment, a lot of press reports we're talking about how the United States seemed to be isolated from many of the other 19 countries that were there. Do you see a real change in America's role in world leadership right now? Do we appear to be isolated? Is there somebody else who's taken up the mantle of world leader?
Well, I think if you look at that G20 summit in Hamburg, you cannot help but be depressed and saddened when there are the 20 major economies of the world are around a table, and when on three big issues, climate change, trade, and immigration and refugees, the United States is completely isolated on each one of them. And a year ago today, we were driving the train on each one of them. We were the global leader on each one of them. Not that we're always right or don't make mistakes. We're not always right, and we do make mistakes. But President Obama, President George W. Bush, President Clinton, President George H.W. Bush, President Reagan, Democrats, Republicans, they all believed that we should be trading with the rest of the world, that we should have our, you know, open to lawful immigration and refugee acceptance into the country, that we should be good to our allies. President Trump used a lot of his speech in Warsaw to castigate the European allies. He's much more critical of democratic countries like Germany than he is of autocratic countries like Saudi Arabia. And if you look at the Pew, P-E-W, opinion polls, and this is a global polling system which is very well regarded, in every single country in the world, with the exception of Russia and Israel, the United States' favorability and credibility has declined precipitously since January 20th. Because President Trump is kind of a bruising, in-your-face, not very polite leader to the rest of the world. And that's not what leadership is. If I learned one thing watching these really skilled leaders like Reagan and Bush and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, they knew how to lead. It's a combination of being frank when you disagree with another country, but also giving them some hope and encouragement and a sense that America is going to be there for them. And that's not the message you get from Donald Trump if you're living overseas.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Ambassador Nicholas Burns is with us this hour talking about the G20 summit, about trade. We've yet to get to the Paris Climate Accord. We, of course, have spent some time talking about the Donald Trump Jr. emails that were released by Donald Trump Jr. this morning and the significance of that, the Russian involvement, which stays with us, hangs over our heads and has for months now. How significant were those emails? Ambassador Burns is right now a professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served in the United States government for 27 years as a career foreign service officer, ambassador to Greece, ambassador to NATO, and has a lot of work in the area of U.S.-Russian relations, senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia affairs, and special assistant to President Clinton and director for Soviet affairs in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network. Our next caller is Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I want to preface my comments first by saying I absolutely agree Donald Trump is probably the worst thing that's ever happened to our country. I think what's come out in the last 2 days, he should be impeached for, you know, encouraging his son-in-law to make these contacts with the Russians. But we on the left risk the call of being hypocrites. You just were very dismissive about Hillary Clinton's emails. I don't want to talk about her emails. I want to talk about what she did while as Secretary of State and as a senator. She made speeches in Russia to Russian groups, $200,000 an hour speeches, which make my stomach turn, and wound up giving uranium rights to those very same groups in Russia after they donated money to the Clinton Foundation. So if we can't call a spade or, you know, corruption on either side, see, I see the Republican and Democratic Party as basically two sides of the same coin, which is absolute corruption. And for the guests to just dismiss Hillary's obviously biased behavior towards the Russians while she was Secretary of State, how could she possibly give them uranium rights? What do we make from uranium?
Ambassador Burns.
Yeah, well, I certainly did not dismiss Secretary Clinton's use of a private email server in her home. I thought that was a great mistake, and she also admitted that during the campaign. You've raised a separate issue, and frankly, I just don't know the details. I'm not aware, I just wasn't aware that Secretary Clinton, when she was a private citizen, had made speeches in Russia for that amount of money. I just was not aware of that. I don't know if it's can be confirmed or not, whether it's true or not. And again, to mix this a U.S. government decision on uranium that was made apparently sometime in the Obama administration with her speeches, I think it might be mixing apples and oranges. And I certainly understand that we've seen lots of evidence in Washington over many decades of improper behavior. But I can tell you, by and large, people serving government are honest, good people who come to Washington and do the right thing. Corruption does not pervade everything. I would never want people to think that, because I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of how a government works. Mm.
There sure is a lot of money, though, that makes the whole thing a little questionable at times, doesn't it? Everybody is beholden to people who are going to help them get elected again.
That's even a separate issue.
Right.
The fact that the Citizens United Supreme Court decision basically allows any wealthy American to contribute huge sums of money to an individual's political campaign and makes that candidate really beholden to the person giving him the money. I think it's very disturbing. I've lived in a lot of different countries around the world, but certainly lived in European countries where there's public financing of campaigns, where you cannot go out and raise $1 billion in a presidential campaign of private money. Mm-hmm. And where, by the way, the campaigns are circumscribed. They're limited to 4 or 5 weeks. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we just had to go through this every 4 years for 4 or 5 weeks, and each candidate was funded by the government, so that you take out the private money being given, and a lot of our members of Congress spend a lot of their time raising money because they have to survive. And I think that's at the core of the problem of what's wrong in our democracy now.
Yeah. And Ray, if you want to send information, I'm not aware of her. I'm aware certainly of her speeches for a whole lot of money to Goldman Sachs and others, but not aware of Russian speeches. As far as the uranium story, I thought that was a Bill Clinton connection too, which is in the recesses of my mind, but we will look at that. But if you have more information about her speeches, we'd be happy to receive it. Okay. Oh, it's getting late. Let's go to Dave in Stevens Point. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask the guest if he agrees that the biggest problem is that people in other countries will work for less money, and that there's really no way around that, and that our country will take a hit because of it.
I think it depends, Dave, on the industry we're talking about. Certainly, one of the previous callers mentioned both steel and garment manufacturing. You know, you can find Bangladeshi workers and Vietnamese workers who do that work much less expensively than an American worker would. But on the other hand, we're at 4.3% unemployment, and the economy is growing right now because we're out-competing the world in a lot of products that our economy can produce both cheaply but also innovatively. So think of what Amazon and Apple are doing and Walmart's doing, and think about what Google's doing, and think about what we're doing in biotechnology. You see in San Diego, Austin, Texas, Raleigh, North Carolina, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, thousands of jobs being created through biotechnology, nanotechnology. So what we have to do, you know, we don't want our workers to make $2 an hour. We want people in this country to earn a better wage than that. Well, we can't do it in steel as much anymore. We can certainly do it in other industries. So retraining, government-supported and state-supported retraining of people, especially older people beyond 30 or 40, it's critical. And I think that's where Washington has fallen down. We've forgotten a lot of people who've been left behind. And it's a point Trump made, and he obviously convinced a lot of people of that
right.
point.
Yeah, and they voted for him. Well, but thank you so much for being with us. It was a really interesting hour, and congratulations on all the work you're doing. I wonder where we're going to be a month from now, don't you?
Oh, I do, too. I think this has been an important day in terms of this investigation. We'll see where it leads. But I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on your program and to talk to so many interesting people who called in.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, he's now a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He is a longtime diplomat serving as U.S. ambassador to NATO and Greece. Also, he was senior director on the White House National Security Council, director of Soviet affairs for President George Herbert Walker Bush. He's been involved in key negotiations with India, Israel, Iran, Russia, and Jerusalem, among many others. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for producing this program and also for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. If we didn't get to you, we had many of them coming in. I would say, why not go to our Facebook page and leave a message, and then we'll read it? That would be good. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. News is coming up. Then Nancy Pearl.